keep on turning. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here. We begin our program today talking about Yemen. The attack by Saudi Arabia the other day put Yemen back in the headlines, but most people don't even know what that country is. There are so few people in our country who even understand the inner workings of that nation and also the international complexities of Saudi Arabia and America and the West and why we're so deeply involved. We've read about the drone attacks that have taken place over the years with al-Qaeda in Yemen and the critique and around that. And many people say, why should we care about Yemen? Well, we're going to talk about that and what that country means. We're here with Dr. Charles Schmitz, professor of geography at Towson University, and one of those people in our country who is an expert on Yemen. Good to have you back in the studio, Charles. Been a while.
Thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Sheila Carapico is with us, who joins us here by phone. She's a professor of political science and international studies, University of Richmond, another one of our national experts on this country. And Sheila, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for the pieces you've been writing in The Nation. They've been great.
Thank you.
So let's begin. I first of all, let's talk about this talk from the news is in the headlines today, and I want to work backwards and inside of this attack by Saudi Arabia on Yemen. And let me start with you, if I might, Sheila, because you've been writing about it, and I've been reading what you've been writing, and an interview you did. So talk a bit about the background to this.
Of the Saudi attack?
Yes, because most people don't even know what that means and how we're connected to it and why should we even care?
Well, I mean, it matters to the United States in part because, of course, it's U.S. weapons being used in a war which is, I think, very unconventional in terms of respect for the rules of war and expectations of due diligence to avoid civilian casualties or displacements. So we should care because we are indirectly involved. We're also providing intelligence and surveillance support. And then we should care because a lot of people are being killed needlessly.
And this attack, Charles, I mean, on Yemen now, I mean, people are being killed needlessly. And there's a complexity about the political situation I'm going to get into with two of you in just a minute. But, I mean, we also forget the huge amount of weaponry and the fact that Saudi Arabia has, per capita, one of the largest, most well-equipped armies on the planet. That's directly linked to the necessity for their oil and more.
Right. The Saudis are they have a tremendous military capability. They are one of the largest arms purchasers outside the developed world, and most of those weapons come from the United States. They typically haven't used those very much, except recently the operation that went into Bahrain, and now this operation in Saudi in Yemen. It's one of the largest the Saudis themselves have carried out. And it's seen as a new Saudi aggressive policy where the Saudis are trying to shape their own defense strategy independent of the United States or slightly independent of the United States.
And how would you say that, Sheila, about their independence from the U.S. and also when we look at the – well, we'll get to the Houthis in a minute. I mean, your sense of that same thing that Charles just spoke about. Sorry.
Well, I mean, what's going on right now is interesting because there's a lot of talk about the Saudi displeasure with the American negotiations with Iran, which is their nemesis, arch rival. And yet the United States has been nothing but wholly supportive of the Saudi war in Yemen. So there's clearly some tension in an historically very strong relationship, of course, between the United States and a terribly repressive regime and the administration. I mean, I don't quite know how to read it, but it's a little bit too much to think that it's a coincidence that the ceasefire has been declared and hopefully gone into effect at exactly the same time as the Gulf leaders have been invited to the United States.
Right.
Every statement that's come out of Washington anywhere in the administration since the beginning of the Saudi bombing campaign on March 25th has been, you know, we're with the Saudis, we support the Saudis, in a way that makes you wonder if anyone in the administration actually knows what's going on.
What that That leads to my next point. I'm glad you said that, Sheila, because then folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Your questions, because many of you have questions about this, because it's not something that we cover very thoroughly in this country, and I want to get to that, which is that, you know, we hear all this about the Houthis all throughout the news as a Yemeni Shias who want to fight and kill the Sunnis, and they're being backed by Iran. But it seems to me, so I'm with Sheila and then going over again to Charles, I mean, it's much more complex than that. And Yemen is a very complex place, and we like to make things simplistic to fit with our foreign policy, I think, sometimes. Sheila?
Yeah, well, actually, my friend Chuck has written a pretty good article some time back about who the Houthis are. But I think, you know, one of the grossest simplifications here is that the Houthis are fighting somehow because they're Shia and they're fighting against people who are Sunnis, when actually almost all of the domestic issues in Yemen have to do with things that are not about religion, but that are about, for example, you know, 30 years of dictatorship, a squandered economy, corruption, a failure to have a genuine transition after the old dictator was deposed. And then, you know, very mundane things like the lifting of fuel subsidies. Certainly the people in the South, the Southern movement, I mean, are certainly, I mean, for them it has nothing to do with religion. It has a lot to do with regionalism, and all of it has a lot to do with power.
So talk about the Houthis.
Yeah, it's a good question. They're described as Shiite rebels, and neither is very accurate. It's true that the Houthi leadership belongs to a class of people who ruled Yemen for about 1,000 years. In 1962, the Republican Revolution overthrew that Zaidi aristocracy. And in the Republican era, the Zaidi aristocracy was marginalized. And the region, Sada, which is in the far north where the Houthi base is, it was also marginalized. And then beginning in the sort of late 80s, as Yemen began, you could feel the beginnings of political liberalization coming. There was an attempt by a younger generation of these folks to have a Zaidi revival, but in modern terms, to sort of reassert Zaidism, because other religious currents were being brought in by the Republicans to fight and to sort of replace Zaidism. Zaidism had, some had said, it almost disappeared in the late 80s. The state began to repress this movement. They saw it as a threat. And Saleh himself, who's now allied with the Houthis, was the one that was repressing them. In the process of repressing them, it transformed into an insurgency that, because of conflicts within the Saleh regime itself, was able to survive. And then it emerges as a party of many parties that are anti-Saleh and very much part of a liberal movement for a new Yemeni state. And if you listen to the Houthis in their participation in the national dialogue, that faction of the Houthis, they're very much for, you know, civil rights and political participation and, you know, pluralism and all this sorts of thing. Then there's a transformation about a year and a half ago, when it appears that as a result of the failure of the GCC-backed transitional government under Hadi, that they seem to have taken a more aggressive stance, and they decided to take out their rivals in the north, Ali Muqsin, the Islah Party.
How are they significant? What does that mean?
The Islah Party and Ali Muqsin were seen by the Houthis as their chief rivals. They were the ones that were they see them as being brought in to be their replacement in the north. And this was in Imran, in the northern part near Sada, where they were. They first took out the Salafi school of at Damaj, Dar al-Hadith, which they had seen as the primary sort of thorn in their side in the north. And at that point, they seemed to have made an alliance with Abdullah Saleh, who had been forced out by the GCC agreement and was looking for a way to get back into power or to reestablish himself in power. And that alliance is the one that took over the capital last September.
So I read something last night about this, early this morning, about the Ottoman Empire when it ruled what is now most of Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And one of the things it said was that the Ottomans looked at Yemen as a place, A, that was critical for their shipping to go up the Strait of Hormuz and up and to get things into the Mediterranean and Asia, and also to protect Mecca and Medina in what is now Saudi Arabia. Mm. And I thought in its modern sense that it's almost the same paradigm in terms of the strategic location of Yemen, how Americans have been involved with that since, with Somalia and Yemen and attacking Al-Qaeda in Yemen, but also the power of Saudi Arabia and the oil that it produces that's also kind of being protected by this as well. And so we play this off as kind of just, you know, another a way, Sheila, to go after Iran as opposed to dealing with what the complexity is and we're thinking about what we should or should not be doing.
I mean, if the Saudis want to fight with Iran, I think they could do it in a different way than bombing Yemen.
Right.
You know, let's bear in mind that Saudi Arabia is one of the richest countries in the world, and Yemen is one of the poorest. It's not an even fight. Even the expression, which you didn't use just now, but has been widely used, of a proxy war is between Iran and Saudi Arabia is terribly misleading because, I mean, you know, I suppose one might, I don't quite subscribe to this, but let's just say for the sake of argument that the Houthis are an Iranian proxy, but the Saudis are not backing any proxy. They're directly engaged. It's an intervention in the same way as the U.S. intervened in Vietnam and invaded Iraq. And the Saudis, I think they do want to be the guarantors of the waterway, which goes from the Suez Canal through the Red Sea to the Bab el-Mandeb, and then that's the route from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean. But they also very much want to be the unchallenged hegemonic power in the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. They have quite a lot of influence among the other wealthy. They've been called petro-monarchies. And part of what's going on now is a piece of the Saudi kind of counter-revolutionary impulse to prevent a genuine transition in Yemen, which, you know, the Saudis were terrified by the prospect of real revolutionary change in Egypt, and they're even more terrified by that prospect in Yemen, which is mm-hmm. a country of like 26 million people right in their backyard.
I go to the phones here, unless you want to, Chuck, you want to ask me real quick before I hit the phones?
No.
410-319-8888. Clarence, line two, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence.
I always question who's supplying the weapons, you know. So when you say that the Saudis are trying to act independently of the United States, it kind of doesn't jive with me because they're not manufacturing their own weapons. So they can't try to act independently of the United States because they're dependent on them for the weapons to do any of these actions. So somewhere along the line, they have to be acting under the behest of the United States, you know, or there's a direct interest that the United States has in whatever actions they take. Thanks, Mr. Steiner.
That's an interesting question. So let's probe this and start with you, Chuck, this time. I mean, I think that part of the issue here is that, I mean, again, even people who oppose a lot of what American foreign policy has done the last 15 years can also look at this thing as simplistically as people who support American policy in the Middle East, right? And so whether it's Saudi Arabia acting on behest, the reality is they're one of the largest purchasers of German-American and weaponry with the oil money that they get from us. And that is all part of the equation. But it may be too simplistic to say they're acting at our behest.
The Saudis traditionally have left defense to the United States. I mean, in a way, the GCC agreement in the early 80s was a response to the Iranian Revolution and an alliance with the United States. It was activated when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. That was the auspices under which the U.S. went in. Of course, it was UN, but it really was, you know, activating the GCC alliance. What is different this time is that the Saudis are nervous about the U.S. Dealings with Tehran. And they would prefer the United States remain completely hostile to Tehran and not have a nuclear agreement with them. And this, the attack on Yemen, in part was to force the American hand, and that's why, you know, the administration has gone sort of head over heels to say, oh yes, of course we back Saudi defense and the Saudi actions, and they have only criticized sort of in very back ways what the Saudis are doing, and so they don't want to show that they are in any way critical of what the Saudis are doing, to reassure them in the context of the U.S. negotiations with Tehran. So that's why the Saudis are, you know, there's talk that Saudis are trying to make an Arab, they call it an Arab, or sometimes called a Sunni, or some kind of a regional defense pact that includes principally Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and that it see itself as that it have its own strategy that be somewhat independent of the United States. At least that's the way they see themselves. I think since the Arab Spring, the Saudis have seen that there's divergence between the way Saudis see the world and the way the United States sees the world. I mean, the Saudis basically opposed the Arab Spring, and as Sheila said, they, you know, tried to create the Arab winter and, you know, to fight the Arab Spring. And the United States was, you know, as Sheila also said, maybe not quite clear on what it was doing, and the Saudis saw that, and they wanted a more aggressive stance that reflected Saudi interests.
And coming back to, as we conclude this conversation, Sheila, but right into the heart of Yemen. I mean, and many of the people who, and even some of the Houthis, were part of what we call the Yemen's Arab Spring, in their opposition to their presidency. So, I mean, it's all complicated with that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the Houthis were only one among, you know, many groups and you know, political parties and other groups, predominantly youth, nationwide, who opposed the 30-some-year dictatorship of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And again, those things had absolutely nothing to do with sectarianism. They had nothing to do with Iran. It was, you know, a popular uprising that remained peaceful for months and months on end, and that had, you know, very, you know, say liberal or progressive objectives in terms of social justice and something closer to democracy than what's been realized before, and, you know, better opportunities for youth and, you know, better custodianship of a fragile ecology, all of those kinds of things, were very much at the forefront of politics in Yemen, you know, for most of the past 5 years.
So very quickly before we end, we have about a minute and a half or so to break. Where does this go next, Chuck? Any thoughts about what? I know you can't be prescient and predict these things. It's too complex. But
it doesn't look good right now. I mean, there's no military winner in this, and there seems to be no movement towards political negotiations. There's supposed to be a conference on the 17th in Saudi Arabia, but you know, the Houthi and Saleh are not going to show up.
They're not going to be there.
And so political solution looks like a long way away.
The sad thing is that some of this also feels like the witnessing another step, another peg in the disintegration of nations in the Middle East, and that's where I'm afraid this is all leading us to, and where that ends up, I don't know. But Sheila, a final thought before we go to break?
Well, just that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of human suffering going on in Yemen. It's slightly different in different places, in Sana'a and Sada'a and the south, but overall, this has been a humanitarian disaster, and the Houthis are not exactly good guys either, I might add. But they are committing atrocities, but the Saudis are committing what I think history will judge to be war crimes against more or less defenseless people.
We've been talking to our nation's leading experts on Yemen, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who you just heard, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, and from right here in Baltimore, Dr. Charles Schmitz, who is professor of geography at Towson University. Good to see you again, Chuck, and Sheila, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
We can take a very brief break and come back. And on our way to break, it's The Happening by the Supremes, which hit number one on this day in 1967. We'll be right back.